Chapter 5. The Tripartite Life tells us that St. Patrick went 3 times across the Shannon into the land of Connaught, and that he spent 7 years preaching in that province, at the end of which time he gave its people his blessing and bade them farewell. As those years were not consecutive, it may be that, in the intervals, the saint returned to watch over his first converts in Ulster and Leinster. The record of our saint's labors in Connaught occupies 25 quattro pages of Mr. Hennessy's translations of the above-mentioned life. It gives us an account of his journeys, and the churches he founded in Roscommon, Conmaria, Mayo, Sligo, and Leitrim, and this so minutely that the reader is perplexed and finds it hard to get a clear sight of the saint himself amidst a maze of references. In like manner, we can trace the saint's course when leaving Connaught. He went up to the north into Tyrone and Donegal, then, retracing his steps to Antrim, he descended to the south, passing through Louth, Cadale, Queen's County, and Ossory, until he arrived at Cashel in Munster. The writer does not mention the length of the time devoted by St. Patrick to evangelizing these counties, but as the life in this part is little more than a diary of the saint's actions, if we measure the time by the number of events recorded, taking the 7 years and Connaught as the basis of our calculation, we must conclude that several years elapsed before he reached Munster. The singular accuracy of the writer in naming places and persons, although wearisome, is valuable, as bearing witness to the veracity of the life. A great part of the record of our saint's apostolate reads like an account of an ordinary bishop's visitation of his diocese. It is because he met with so little opposition that we miss in his life those struggles and alternations of fortune which make up the lives of other missionaries and enable writers to give a distinct picture of their labors. St. Patrick in his work, as we have found observed of his personal character, is well nigh lost in the blaze of his own glory, with the exception of the stern and obdurate Legare, who soon disappears from the scene. There is no formidable opponent to bring out the saint's greatness, no background to the picture, which is consequently indistinct from its very brightness. For the same reason, there is little to say about the conversion of Ireland, less perhaps than of that of any other country. It was like a campaign where all the victories are on one side. In Munster, miraculous signs and wonders had prepared the minds of the people for the coming of the man of God. In the south, the provincial king resided as Cashel of the Kings, as it was then called, and thither St. Patrick directed his steps, for it seems to have been his custom to seek out the rulers of the provinces which he entered, knowing that if he could win them over, the people would more easily follow. Agnus, the prince, whom the saint found there, appears at this time to have been acting for his father, whom he ultimately succeeded on the throne. It is related that when the prince arose on the morning of the day of the saint's arrival at Cashel, he found all the idols in the fort prostrate on the ground, and that, influenced doubtless by this sign from heaven, he received Patrick and his followers joyfully. While the saint preached and prepared the people for baptism, Agnus stood beside him, and the sharp point of the sacred crozier, or staff of Jesus, upon which the saint was supporting himself, resting on the prince's foot, pierced it. But Agnus gave no sign of pain, and when the blood flowing on the ground revealed the torture endured by the patient and heroic listener, St. Patrick asked him why he had been silent, to which the prince replied that he had supposed he was only submitting to one of the ordinances of the faith. When we compare the account given by St. Evan of the apostle's work in Munster with the earlier parts of the life, we are struck by the signs of that rapidly increasing power which was so soon to make St. Patrick master of the country. We are told how men of North Munster, to the north of Limerick, came in their boats, a very fleet, as St. Evan describes it. They found the saint at Terryglass in Ormond, on the shores of Lough Derg, and were baptized there. Then St. Patrick ascended a hill in Finini, northwest of Domnock Moor, which commanded the view to the north of Limerick, and gave his blessing to the men of North Munster, and also to the islands and the country north and west. From St. Evan's account, our saint does not appear at this time to have entered Clare or Kerry, but before he retraced his steps, he prophesied of the saints who were to follow him and carry on his work, of St. Sinanus, The green island in the west, said St. Patrick, in the mouth of the sea, the lamp of the people of God shall come into it, who will be the head of the council to the district, i.e., synod of Enos Cathag, 60 years from this. He also foretold the birth of St. Brendan, of the race of Ulla Alta, one of the greatest of the Irish monastic founders in the century after St. Patrick. St. Evan gives a graphic account of the enthusiastic devotion manifested towards our saint by the people of Munster. After that, Patrick founded cells and churches in Munster, and had ordained person of every grade, and healed all sick persons, and resuscitated the dead. He bade them farewell, and left his blessing with them. When the people heard that the saint had left them, they rose up like one man and followed him, overtaking him at Brosna in King's County, and filling the air with shouts of joy at seeing him again. St. Patrick blessed them once more, and continued on his journey. It is at this time, when the saint was passing through Leinster on his way to the north, that we find the record of the martyrdom of St. Audran, the only martyr of the Irish Church in St. Patrick's time. An obstinate pagan, named Forage Barad, had long nourished an intense hatred against St. Patrick, in consequence of the destruction of the chief idol of Erin, Crab Crag, in the Plain of Adoration. For it was this, says St. Evan, that was a god to Folage. He had declared his intention of assassinating St. Patrick, but St. Evan adds that, for some reason or other, St. Patrick's people did not inform him of this. Perhaps experience had taught them that it was useless to warn their master against such dangers. We gather from St. Evan's narrative that St. Patrick sometimes traveled alone with Audran, passing swiftly through the country in one of the light chariots then used in Ireland, and that one day, when the faithful servant knew that they were likely to fall in with the Folage barrage, he asked St. Patrick to change places with him and take the reins. The saint consented, and by his stratagem Orderon won the crown of martyrdom, falling beneath the blow intended for St. Patrick. Footnote. Father Colligan, following Farrar's catalogue, fixes the feast of St. Audran, martyr and disciple of St. Patrick, on the 26th of October. It is remarkable that the proto-martyrs of Ireland and England, St. Audran and St. Alban, both met death in the same way, each offering his own life to save that of a priest. End footnote. The foundation of the church and see of Armagh is the next great event commemorated in St. Patrick's life, and in the course of St. Evan's narrative, it came almost immediately after St. Patrick's return from Munster. The territory of Mecha, or Armagh, which was held at this time by a certain man named Darare, whom St. Evan styles a prosperous and venerable person, seems to have been but a small one. At one time, however, it had been a place of great importance, owing to the neighborhood of the fortress of Emania, the residence of the kings of Ulster. The immense rath, or mound, which its deep circular entrenchments is still to be seen, and in the middle of the 17th century, Colligan describes Emania, with its broad trenches and the rugged and towering ruins of its walls, as it still signs of its former splendor. At first Darare refused to give the saint the land he had chosen, which was on a hill to the north of the city, but he allowed him to build a church lower down, where, according to St. Evan, the saint remained a long time. Darare had soon reason to regret his refusal. He was seized with sickness, which seemed unto death. Patrick blessed water and sent it to him, and by its miraculous power the sickness departed. Darare then sent the saint a thank-offering in the shape of a brazen cauldron, one receiving which he merely said, Deo gratias. On the return of the messengers, Darare asked them what St. Patrick had said, and in their ignorance of the language, they replied that he had only said one word, gratiam. Darare was indignant at the saint's indifference to his gift, and ordered his servants to bring it back, upon which Patrick again repeated, Deo gratias. When Darare heard this, he wondered much, and said, This is a good word with them, gratiam, when giving it to him, and gratiam, when taking it away from him. And he and his wife, touched by the saint's patience, went to him and gave him back their gift, adding the grant of the hill which they had refused. The Book of Armagh thus completes the narrative, and they went forth together, both St. Patrick and Darare, to view the admirable and well-pleasing gift, and they ascended the height, and found a roe and a little fawn with their lying on the spot where the altar of the Northern Church of Ardmacha now stands, and St. Patrick's companions wanted to catch the fawn and kill it, but the saint objected and would not permit them. Nay, he even took up the fawn himself and carried it on his shoulders, and the roe followed him like a pet lamb until he laid down the fawn on account of imminence at the north side of Armagh, where, according to the statements of those who are familiar with the ground, miraculous attestations are to be witnessed to this day. It is the opinion of those learned in topography of Armagh that the hill on which the new cathedral of Armagh is now built is the very identical spot to which, like the good shepherd, St. Patrick carried the fawn, a touching image of that Church of Ireland which for ages he has loved so tenderly and borne in his paternal arms. The founding of the church in See of Armagh was evidently regarded by St. Evan as the crowning event in the missionary career of the Apostle of Ireland, and with it therefore, following this writer, we shall in this chapter conclude the chronological part of our narrative, only reserving the history of St. Patrick's death for the conclusion of the book. But before entering upon the subject of the virtues and miracles of St. Patrick, we must give an account of that memorable event which is recorded in St. Patrick's epistle to Coroxius. It seems from internal evidence that the circumstances which led the saint to write the letter took place many years after his arrival in Ireland, for he tells us that he had sent a previous letter to Coroxius by a priest who he himself had taught from his infancy, unless, indeed, we suppose that he had been under our saint's care before the mission to Ireland in 432. We have the narrative in the saint's own words. It may be that news had crossed the channel of the change which had come over the warlike and adventurous Irish Scots, once the terror of their neighbors on the adjacent coast of Britain, but who had now been subjugated by the vicar of the Prince of Peace and taught to sing the Psalm of David in place of their war songs, and that of Coroxius, a Caradoc, called in the tripartite King of Britain, and who is generally supposed to have been a Welsh prince whose name is found in the records of that country in the 5th century, thought this is a good opportunity for plunder, as well as for wiping out old scores. On the day following a great religious ceremony, when a multitude of the people had been baptized, and were still clothed in white, with the charism of the neophytes, in St. Patrick's words, still flaming on their brows, they were set upon by Caradoc and his band, who slew some and carried others into captivity. St. Patrick was overwhelmed with anguish of heart when the news of this outrage reached him, for his own experiences enabled him to enter into the sorrows of his children. Moreover, the fact that the sacrilegious Caradoc was a Christian made the crime all the more horrible. He first sent a priest attended by several clerics with a letter to Caradoc. This letter has not been preserved, but from the saint's account it is clear that it is written in a gentle spirit, in the hope of bringing the sinner to repentance, and that it was after the saint's messengers had been rejected with scorn that he wrote the epistle we still possess, which may be more appropriately termed a pastoral letter, in which he denounces and excommunicates the proud and obdurate prince. The saint begins by announcing his mission and authority, continuing in a strain of mingled anger and sorrow, which gives us a vivid picture of that heart which, like St. Paul's, was so vehement in its tenderness. I, Patrick, an unlearned sinner, for all that I have been constituted bishop in Ireland, and from God I have received that which I am, I dwell amongst the strangers as a proselyte and a fugitive for the love of God. He is my witness that it is so. It is not my wish to utter such hard and stern words, but I am urged by zeal for God and the truth of Christ, who has raised me up for the love of my neighbors and children, for whom I have abandoned my country and parents, and would give even my soul unto death if I were worthy. Then he declares that he had written the letter with his own hand to Coroxius and his soldiers. Quote, I do not say to my fellow citizens, nor to the fellow citizens of the pious Romans, but to those who dwell with demons, because of their evil and hostile deeds. Wherefore, be it known to every man who fears God, that they are separated from me, and from Christ my God, for whom I am ambassador. After this he breaks out into passionate lamentations. What shall I do, O Lord? Lo, the sheep are torn to pieces around me. Ravening wolves have devoured the flock of Christ, which, with the greatest rapidity, was wonderfully multiplying in Ireland. I cannot number the sons of the Irish and the daughters of princes who are monks and virgins of Christ. It is the custom of the Christians of Rome and Gaul to send holy men fitted for the office with much gold to the Franks and the other heathen nations to redeem those captives who are Christians. You slay them and sell them to strange nations who know not God. You deliver the member of Christ, as it were, into a den of ill fame. What hope in God have you? Or he agrees with you? Or encourages you? God will judge him. I know not what I can say, or how I continue to speak to those departed children of God, struck down by the sword, cruel above all measures. For it is written, Weep with them that weep. And again, if one member suffers anything, all the other members suffer with it. Therefore the church weeps and mourns her sons and daughters, as yet spared by the sword, but reserved and exiled into distant countries where sin abounds and is openly shameless. There free-born Christians are sold and made the slaves, especially of those most wicked, detestable, and apostate pigs. Therefore I cry out with grief and sorrow, O beautiful and most beloved brethren and children, whom I have begotten in Christ in such multitudes that I cannot number you, what shall I do for you? End quote. Caradoc was insensible to the saints' threats and prayers, and the tradition retained in the old lives records that a fate like that of the king of Babylon fell upon him, and that on a certain day, as he stood in the midst of his attendants, suddenly, in the sight of all, he took the shape of a wolf and disappeared in the distance. And Jocelyn adds, this fact no one can fairly discredit who reads the narrative of the wife of Lot turned into a rock, and that of the king of Nebuchadnezzar.